Hello, and welcome to the fourth season of The Good Stuff, a podcast brought to you by The Wheel, featuring news, views, and inspiring voices from across Ireland's non-profit sector. I'm Rob Brown, and this season we'll be chatting with representatives from a broad range of organisations about some of the more difficult challenges currently being faced by our sector, and about some of the amazing people who take on those challenges every day in order to help bring us all towards a stronger and more vibrant civil society. This year, we've seen the community and voluntary sector pummeled by an ever-worsening recruitment and retention crisis, pay disputes, ongoing geopolitical and domestic economic pressures, and increases in demand across the board. Most particularly, the plight of organisations providing fundamental social and community health services under Sections 10 of the Housing Act 1988, Section 39 of the Health Act 2004, and Section 56 of the Child and Family Agency Act 2013 has become painfully obvious to all. Many of these organisations have found themselves at risk of total collapse this past year due to widening pay disparity and a resulting exodus of skilled and experienced staff. We've seen some organisations who provide care which is integral to the well-being of Irish civil society lose almost 50% of their experienced workforce. And severe shortfalls in the provision of care for some of our most vulnerable is becoming more and more common, as noted in analyses like the Ombudsman for Children's Office recent Nowhere to Turn report. Here at The Wheel, we have campaigned tirelessly together with partners and members throughout the Irish CV sector to draw attention to these interconnected crises. Our pre-budget submission for Budget 2024 highlighted 12 key asks reflecting the expressed needs of our members. Indeed, in the weeks immediately preceding the budget, these frustrations culminated in an almost unanimous vote in favour of an all-out strike among people working across the Section 39, 56 and 10 spectrum. On the 6th of October, we joined a coalition of 8 voluntary health and social care service providers and charity sector representative bodies in publishing an open letter to the Taoiseach, requesting his intervention in order to address the very real concerns of those planning to strike. On Tuesday, October 8th, with our entire sector nervously looking on, Budget 2024 was announced. And while we welcomed the increase to the VAT compensation scheme for which many of us had been campaigning for years, ultimately, the details of this year's budget did little to allay the anxieties of those looking to government to shore up a sector, which is often referred to as a most valuable partner to government itself. Luckily for all those involved, negotiations undertaken at the Workplace Relations Commission in the 11th hour successfully averted strike action. But given the increasingly straitened circumstances that continue to affect large swathes of our sector, how can charity, voluntary and community organisations hope to keep up the levels of vital services that they have hitherto provided for us all? Over the next 3 episodes, we'll certainly take the time to look at some of the not-so-good stuff affecting our members as 2023 draws to a close. But more importantly, we'll try to focus on the ways in which the people who keep our sector going, those who put their all into keeping civil society afloat, are managing to make things work and, ultimately, to keep the lights on. In our first episode, this season, we discuss one of the biggest issues facing our sector today. The ever-widening pay gap between thousands of workers in the charity and voluntary sector and their counterparts in organisations directly funded by the state, which has had a debilitating impact on the efficacy and viability of many health and social service providers across the country. The collapse in July of talks at the Workplace Relations Commission was greeted with a widespread sense of frustration, which ultimately led to balloting on strike action. The strike itself was only recently called off pending conversations with union membership. And while government has committed to some initial pay increases and the beginning of a process aimed at addressing key impasses, the conditions for people working in the sector have yet to be significantly improved. How then can we as a unified sector act to address these complexities? And perhaps just as importantly, how can we communicate the need for improved conditions for staff and service users to a wider public? On this episode, we talk with Dr. Shayna Cohen, CEO of the Think Tank for Action on Social Change, or TASC, about a recent study produced in conjunction with The Wheel. The Future of Public Service Delivery by the Community and Voluntary Sector analyses staffing, funding, and the demand for services among hundreds of Section 39, 56, and 10 organizations who deliver essential public services countrywide in diverse areas like health, disability, family support, childcare, elder care, homelessness, and addiction. Shayna chats with The Wheel's own campaigns manager, Dr. Emily Burke, about her work in bringing The Wheel's 2024 pre-budget submission, A Budget for Civil Society, to fruition, as well as how our submission encapsulates many of the key concerns shared by our members. We're joined today by Dr. Emily Burke, who is The Wheel's own campaigns manager. We, of course, are on the National Association of Charities, Community Groups and Social Enterprises. And by Dr. Shane Cohen,
who's the director of the Think Tank for Action Social Change, or TASC. Today, we're going to hear from Emily and Shana on the TASC report that was published in association with The Wheel earlier this year, and on the current state of the community and voluntary sector in Ireland, and some of the more profound difficulties that it's been facing in the recent past. So in particular, we're going to think a little bit about organizations that are referred to broadly in the media and in the sector as Section 39, 10, and 56 organizations. So Emily, if you could, first of all, maybe tell us a little bit about the kinds of work that the people who work in Section 39, 10, and 56 organizations do.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess the short answer to the question of who these people are and what they do is that they are people working in health, housing, and children's charities primarily, and they're the people who get the supports from those charities. So calling them, as he said, Section 39, 10, and 56 is a shorthand for the acts under which they're funded by the Department of Housing, the HSE, and TUSLA. So rather than directly providing these services through the state contracts them out to charities and voluntary organisations, and the people who use those organisations are getting residential disability services, they're getting addiction treatment and counselling, nursing home care, family supports, emergency accommodation. It's a long list. It's thousands of organisations. So it's broad, I suppose, a broad range of staff. Lots of them would be, you from the list there, it's no surprise that lots of them would be trained nurses, trained counsellors, social workers, care providers, and the like. And the issue that's facing them at the moment is that they're earning considerably less than they would working directly for the state in an identical role. So, for example, you might have a nurse in a public hospital providing dementia care, but somebody providing identical care that is delivered through a voluntary organisation or voluntary hospital instead could be earning 10 to 20% less than that same nurse in the public service. So the gap has come about since 2008, when funding levels were cut during times of austerity. And there has been a whole process of pay restoration and funding increases for people working in the public sector. But it has never happened for this other set of people who similarly are providing public services, but they happen to be doing it within slightly different structures. So because of this, people are quite understandably looking for better paid, more fairly paid work and moving into the public sector and the private sector, and away from charities and voluntary organisations. And we've seen cases where 30%, 40%, 50% of staff have been leaving organisations within the space of a year, and it's causing really, really big crises within those organisations because it's not a sustainable way to run or deliver services. And what we keep on hearing particularly is that they're having trouble not just replacing staff, but replacing them with staff who have similar levels of experience. So this is an issue that's been going on for years, that we've been campaigning on for years, but it has kind of hit a crisis level recently. And many services, their ability to keep the doors open, I suppose, is under threat.
Yeah. And I think, a lot of what you've spoken about is outlined in really great detail in what we refer to in-house as the TASC report, which is one of many TASC reports. But the report recently published by TASC, The Future of Public Service Delivery by the Community and Voluntary Sector, which was published June or July of this year. And in that, one of the points that's made very, very early on in the report is that, well, the exercise in data collection itself is critical for the sector, as it allows organizations and government agencies to examine trends in staffing, service delivery, and funding and in order to assess their impact. And I guess my first question for you, Shane, would be that, like, how does gathering this kind of data and assessing the impact help this sector to affect change? And do you think that policymakers are looking to the kinds of really, really fine and important detail that's being put out in reports like the recent TASC report?
Answer to the question, second question, no, they're not. answer to the first question. So I wrote this report with the help of a couple of people, but I did the majority of the work. And I've known this for a while, and it was one of the conversations I've had with the Wheel. There's not great data collection in the sector. And I found this when I was talking to the organizations and trying to gather data for the report. The data is not systematic, so you can't really, sometimes it's difficult to compare one organization to another because they don't collect data in the same way. And you can understand that, but sometimes they're responding to different funders who have their own requirements, and that's how they collect data, is to respond to funders. But I think in order to present an argument to the government that is separate from their own funding contracts, from whatever agency is paying for them, depending on what kind of, you know, what number of organization they are, there needs to be, and this is one thing to just make a pitch, I've proposed the task to us. It's like, every 2 years or so, there's a report on the sector. Right now, the Wheel says a survey of salaries, but the problem is there's nothing wrong with that, and that's fine, but it's just a survey of salaries. What we need for like a report like this is, and I think this would be helpful for the government as well, is data collection annually on staff turnover, data collection annually on different types of staff turnover, whether it's frontline services. You could even differentiate between residential care and day services for some organizations, and then management. And then another, how many times or often does somebody in a management role have to take on a frontline service role? It would be like a list of 20 questions, and every organization that is receiving government funding would fill it out, and they'd have it in front of them. And it may be a bit time consuming, but I don't think it would be that much once everybody got the hang of it. And you would have a set of data that say, this is actually what's happening. So with this report, the challenge was, there wasn't the kind of, oh, we don't really collect data on that, or we don't have the same kind of data. And then, I was looking at, in some of the tables in the report, you'll see their gaps. It could be they don't have that kind of activity, but it also just, we just don't, you know, we don't collect that kind of data. Waiting list links would be an obvious one. How long are the waiting list links? If you don't have a waiting list, why don't you? But, you know, across, if you had like 30 organizations that had an annual statistic or a 6-month statistic on waiting lists, that would be a very powerful piece of data to show to the government, like, look how much, you know, stress we're under as, you know, in terms of the impact of funding and not having enough staff. We have these long waiting lists, but yeah. So anyway, that would be my suggestion. And I think it would be helpful for the government. They may not necessarily want it in a sense, because that helps build an argument for greater funding. But I think in the end, you want to know what the problem is. And the only way to really know what the problem is to collect the data.
Yeah, you can't hear me furiously nodding on the microphone, but I've been furious. So many of you, somebody working on campaigns in the Wheel, do you think that this kind of a regularized program of data collection throughout the sector is something that could roll out quickly? Do you think that's something that not to speak entirely for our members, but do you think that this is the kind of thing that the sector would embrace?
I think you probably get a lot of different answers to that question from a lot of different corners, because there are a few. So I suppose, number one, everyone is going to silently scream when asked to collect more data and fill out another form. It is, you know, one of the things I guess we hear again and again in the Wheel from members is the strain of governance. And this isn't governance, but it is another process to undertake. But I think it is something that even within that, more and more organizations are looking to collect data in a more regularized way, be that for funders, be that for anything. The more we can adhere to something kind of collective that can be used in different ways, I think there's a strong argument for that. The other challenge with something like this, and in the crisis situation that we're in, is that as you say, there definitely isn't the regularized data across all of the organizations. But you know, I know there are organizations who have been involved in the campaign who have done pretty detailed data collection exercises and presented those figures and put them out there. And there is an amount, I suppose we're at a point now where I would say data is probably not the issue in terms of action on this. It's certainly, very helpful to have and very necessary to have. But we have, we may not have all the statistics, but we have enough information to know that this is a big crisis and this is something that needs immediate resolution. And definitely in terms of tracking it into the future, that kind of data is incredibly valuable. But there's, I suppose there's also an argument that the data that we have so far is maybe not landing where it might, we might like it to land in terms of response.
So I guess then the argument would be, the data we have at the moment shows that there's a need for change and there's a need for improvement in funding and support. But Shana, what I'm hearing you saying is that even after that, let's say that happens tomorrow and funding falls from the sky in the sector, is the pressure is relieved, that moving forward, we need to keep our eye on how things are being run more concretely so that we can constantly know where we're positioned. If we'd have had this data 10 or 15 years ago, is that?
Yeah, I think it's just... it's just a bias because maybe I'm coming at from a position of as an academic, as a researcher, but I think it's good to show trends. And I'm one of the report, the follow-on report that we had talked to the Wheel about, and the organizations came together for this report, was the impact, was more detailed data on impact. Some of that is in the report about there's rising demand and decreasing services. But you're putting together piecemeal data to show that. So, it's some organizations have collected really good data, let's say on drug rehabilitation, and this is what's happening to residential services. And so you can have an example of pressure, but it would be, I think, worthwhile seeing if you could do that on a more large scale basis. Like, you may not be able to do it because it's different types of services, but you could say that waiting lists are a good one. So waiting lists have increased 16% for 70% of organizations in the space of 2 years. And it's a kind of, I think in talking to the government, it's a good piece of information to give to a civil servant to say this is what's happening, because it just encapsulates the problem. You could say, you have a parallel between staff numbers are down by 20%, demand for services are up by 40% across this number of organizations. There's an obvious cause and effect. And I think for policy purposes, it's useful to keep monitoring the situation.
Yeah, I mean, even from the numbers that you were able to get for the report, it seems pretty obvious that what we're seeing is an increase in demand, both from the government side, as in funding into the CV sector is going up and percentages of provision are going up. And then we're also seeing an increase in demand from service users. More people need access. Before COVID, after COVID, and into today. But what we're not seeing at the moment is I guess, or from my perspective, it looks like we're not seeing a complementary increase in funding. Can you see a rationale for why that's happening? Or is it just a question of government says no money, government says there's not money there? Or is there a rationale behind why we're not seeing the funding come up to where it very obviously seems to need to be?
I think there are a couple of things going on. From a perspective of a civil servant, you're going to try to save money wherever you can. And so that you're going to say, okay, this is an area where, and unfortunately, social care ends up being the area where you say, okay, this is where we'll wait on funding until we absolutely have to put more money into it. It's not prescriptive. It's always reactionary, unfortunately. I don't think that's just Ireland. But I think there are a couple things going on. Just to give you an anecdote again from drug rehabilitation, one of the pieces of research was somebody told me about was that women and people who are drug addicts have been drug addicts, they're finding aging drug addicts is a problem. Like among women, they'll go into early onset menopause and it'll be severe symptoms that are related to addiction. Or you're having older men, they're aging with addiction. And so you need specialized services, which means you need people trained in a specific area, which means you need investment in that area. And again, go back to the reactionary comment, what you're trying to do is get the government to keep pace with all of these changing problems. And that, it may not be enough staff in the civil service to say, okay, we're going to assign two people to keep pace with changing problems across all of these areas of social care. I mean, it could be, we're aging in general, so you're going to need more advanced dementia care, more physiotherapists who understand an aging body. So it's the government will have to keep up with the scale of problems. Then there's funding. And rightly so, the government is asking charities to be more transparent and accountable and higher quality. I think that there is an argument for that, but they haven't funded it. So that's an entirely separate issue. But it again goes back to we'll wait. And at some point, you know, we just can't wait any longer. Well, then we'll give. But then the last point I'll make is that in Ireland, as well as other countries, but I think in Ireland particularly, there's this argument like our identity is our rate of economic growth and how economic policy is governing tax receipts, preserving our status as a solvent country. We have high levels of public debt, but it's, look, we have all these tax receipts coming in. To turn around and say, actually, that's not the model for the future. And, you know, it's scared to death of inflation. If you raise anybody's salary, it's just going to propel inflation. You have to think differently about economic policy before you can, or what your priorities are. And then, you know, before you can really tackle some of the social problems in Ireland.
Yeah, I would echo that, you know, I think it is widely accepted. I don't think it's an out there thing to say that we have been underinvested in public services in Ireland for decades now, and there is a game of catch up being played while, as you say, new problems are emerging all of the time. And I suppose the thing about the charity sector is that so much of it is working with the people who may not be able to make themselves the forefront of priorities. So, you know, there can be a sense in the sector that this is people's vocation. I think we're probably going to talk about that in a little while, that people will kind of do this because they care and they'll stick to it. So, and they kind of have in many ways. We have a brilliant resource here in the charity sector. We have people who are really dedicated to the work that they do, who understand the problems in maybe a more holistic way than they might in other respects. But they really have to fight to have the work recognized. And as I said, you know, they will go above and beyond, but everybody does have a limit. And many people have clearly reached theirs now. And possibly that crisis has been allowed to get to that point because of that sense that organizations will figure it out and they'll keep figuring out how to keep the doors open and keep delivering these services because that is what they were put on this earth to do as people. But you can only be so efficient, you can only cut costs so much. And like when it's 2023 and you're still on 2008 funding levels, you know, you can only make those sums add up so far. So I think it is a history of underinvestment, and now we're seeing a really, really, really urgent need to catch that investment up, so that the sector can keep being here into the future.
That's really interesting, because whenever I hear you talk about this particular issue, and whenever we sort of think about how to talk about this issue publicly, I'm always reminded that there's two very distinct cohorts of people that we're talking about who are intimately connected. One is the people in receipt of the services, and one is the people providing the services. And I guess you touched on it a little bit, which was a question I was going to ask you both if you wanted to speak to a little bit, which is, the numbers in and of themselves are quite extraordinary when you look at sort of funding numbers and percentages of provision for certain sectors, homelessness, you know, addiction services, mental health services. But there are people, as you say, Emily, who are actually in there doing these jobs every day and providing these services. Can you, if for somebody, say, listening to this podcast who has never thought about someone who's working in the community voluntary sector and who's maybe doing these kinds of jobs, could you explain to them what it is that is making their position so difficult? Why are they looking for change, for more funding, for an improvement in their situation?
I mean, so I guess the core of it, as I said before, is that they are, a lot of these staff are still on funding or salary scales that were in place in 2008. So many people have not effectively had a pay raise in, I don't want to calculate how long ago 2008 was, what, 15 years? And, you know, we've all been hearing everything about inflation. We've been hearing cost of living crises. It's biting hard for people. And that's just that's purely the financial side of it. What it's coming with as well is, when you have these huge, huge rates of turnover in an organization, you're the people who work there are in a constant state of crisis management. For example, I mean, the example I keep coming back to, because I've talked to people working in the area a few times, is drugs and alcohol services, where you need people who are very well trained. Like, it's a very frontline service in the most, you know, the, I suppose it's the exemplary version of a frontline service. And what they're finding is that, as I said, they can't replace staff who are leaving with sufficiently experienced staff. So they're recruiting people who are quite new to the job, who are still learning the ropes. They obviously have to undergo training to get up to grips with this. They can't handle the same numbers of clients that they might, that a more experienced person might be able to. So the services are more under pressure. They have fewer staff. The people who are there are less well equipped to handle the caseload, but they're still trying to handle the people who are coming through the door. And so these staff are burning out and they're leaving. And, this, you know, it's a very vicious cycle in this respect for people in those organizations. And it's not purely, I mean, it's the root cause is the levels of pay, but it's being exacerbated by all of these things blossoming out from that.
Do you have any thoughts on that, Shane? Anything you would add? Or?
I guess the other side is that the HSE and the local government and all the, like, the public sector can offer competitive wages. It doesn't mean that the work will necessarily be, is, you know, more appealing. It could be, but it may not be. I think anecdotally, from what I understand, people like to work in the charity sector because of the flexibility and the, it's not as, maybe not as structured as a public sector in some ways. But yeah, I think the pay and benefits and, like, things like travel time and paid leave and all the rest of it, it's not the same working conditions.
Pensions,
etc. And it doesn't make sense to offer a service that's essentially a public service, but you have one that's provided for and one's on the cheap. Because inevitably, I mean, this isn't rocket science. Inevitably, you are going to have burnout from staff, but the problem, it goes back, this is, again, data collection. The problems are not going to go away. You're just going to have more addicts who are not being treated. Or you're going to have more people who are homeless, or you're going to have more people who don't have home care. It doesn't, you know, and politically, let's say home care or child care, politically, that's a total hot potato. So that's why in some ways all the economic logic behind it doesn't make sense, because you're going to have a population that's aging without access to home care and access to spaces in nursing homes. So that's not resolving the problem. All it's doing is creating more problems. Fintan O'Toole, the last thing I'll say, Fintan O'Toole had a recent column that did government doesn't want to talk about children living in poverty. And for a country as wealthy as Ireland, it's not thinking into the future of all the consequences of having children grow up in poverty. So that's what's, you know, to become so fixated on an economic model that you're ignoring all these, like, explosions happening around you. It's like, that's what it's not rocket science, but also it doesn't make sense why it's not happening.
What do you think then, or can we, what can be done? Budget is coming, right? As of recording today, we're going to be looking at the budget early next week. Let's say you could control the minds of, you know, Taoiseach and the rest of the ministers responsible for bringing the budget to the public and make them say whatever you wanted them to say. What would you love to hear them say? What changes, structural changes, do you think that we could make to immediately start moving things in the right direction?
Obviously, I would argue that they do need to equalize pay. And you're not talking about such a significant workforce that you need to run, you know, say, oh, inflationary pressures, et cetera. I don't think that this isn't, you know, this is a small portion of the workforce. But it shouldn't just be about the workforce. Again, it's like we're going to invest in tackling these issues because ultimately it costs a lot more to resolve over time than they would cost to deal with them right now. And that is what they should say.
Emily?
Yeah, well, in terms of our own budget campaigning that we've been doing, that question of pay equalization is obviously the very first piece to just try and stop the staff hemorrhaging away from these organizations. And from there, I think it's really important that not only do we catch people up now in terms of wages, in terms of funding, but that is linked to public service pay increases in the future so that we're not back here again in a year or 18 months having an identical conversation. And I mean, then there's a whole conversation to be had after that about where we go. But in terms of a first step, in terms of immediate, maybe not a full resolution, but an immediate tackling of the crisis, it is that it's that two pieces of pay parity and linking to future increases.
What would you say to someone who's been listening to you both talk for the last few minutes who might not have thought about this issue very carefully before? Do you think that there's advice that you would give to someone about what they can do, aside from maybe giving up their time or naming the charity? Do you think that there's ways that the public at large can improve the situation?
Yeah, I guess my answer depends on who you are listening to this podcast. If you are someone, for some reason, listening to a charity representative podcast but don't work for a charity or are not connected to charities in any way, it's maybe having, tuning yourself into what charities are doing in Ireland and how they work, because we know that a lot of the public, you know, the majority of people are very broadly well disposed towards what charities are doing. They think they're having a really positive impact, but they don't necessarily recognize the breadth of that work, the breadth of what they do. I mean, as we were discussing earlier, I mean, I think a lot of people may not realize that nursing home care is provided by charities, or that 70% of disability services in Ireland are provided by charities. But it's also smaller stuff as well. Getting away from the subject a little bit, but you know that like the dog that you have sitting at home, he might have come from a charity. That it intersects with our lives in many, many ways, and to have an appreciation of that and the importance of that. If you are on the flip side, someone who works for a charity or is involved with a charity, and that's why you're listening, then if your organization is particularly affected by this issue, then we would recommend getting in touch with us at The Wheel, because we do. We have been doing a lot of campaigning work on this. We have an ongoing campaign, working with organizations in the sector, working with politicians, just talking to, stakeholders on all sides to try and move this along. So if it is something that you'd like to talk to us about, because, you know, as Shane is saying, the more information we have, the more data we have from the more different corners, the better our argument is, the stronger it is. So you can get in touch with us to talk some more about it.
Sure. I think if I remember the public, following the charities actually may have a much bigger role in your life than you realize, but also imagine a world without charities. And so I think that's one of the messages with the campaign, is that if these services can't continue, they will have an impact. They will have an impact, and not, you know, politicians on voters, but also just, it's if you can imagine like something that you always expect to be there and then it's not there anymore because there's not enough funding. So it's important then to understand the role charities have in your life. It could be like Jigsaw, right? You know, people send their kids to Jigsaw. What happens if Jigsaw doesn't have enough staff to see your child? I think it's important to understand the role that they play and what would happen if they're not there, or if you can't get an appointment because there's not enough staff. And if you are a member of a charity, I would echo the same thing. The more data that you can provide and what's happening, even like another, you know, how many hours a year do you think you're spending on governance? I think that's a really important piece of data that we should have, because that is not funded by the government to spend that time. See, it needs to be funded. If you expect people to put those hours into compliance, then you need to make sure that they have the capacity to do that. And you'd want the capacity if you actually have to do multiple jobs because you're understaffed.
Yeah, I know that was a big chunk of our pre-budget submission at The Wheel, was the issue of governance and compliance costs and time investment and, you know, an increasing, as you mentioned earlier on, an increasing burden, but like a lack of provision to sort of fund that.
Yeah, I mean, it's that piece of very rightly expecting, you mentioned it earlier, Shaina, you know, professionalism and transparency and everything from charities increasingly, that is a good expectation and a right expectation. But on the flip side, people need to be funded to be able to do that. And it's, again, if you look to the kind of public attitudes research about charities, it's really interesting because you find that a sort of surprisingly high number of people think that no charity staff should be paid at all, yet simultaneously think that they should be extremely professional and delivering extremely high quality services to incredibly high standards, which they should. But there's a square, I'm completely getting the phrase wrong, a square to circle, a circle to square there. In that, you know, if you want something very professional, you need to pay the professional people to do it. And yes, we do have a piece in our pre-budget campaign around provision of governance costs and recognizing, you know, in state funding contracts or private funded contract, that time is required in order to do this, and a percentage should be allowed to be dedicated to that for organizations.
Shana, as you said yourself, as an academic, and you mentioned earlier that you tend to approach these kind of questions from an academic perspective, but do you have hope? Is a bit of a woolly word, but like, what would your hopes be for the future of the nonprofit sector in Ireland? Do you see a way forward?
I think there are two things that could happen in terms of funding. One is that the government recognizes that they've contracted out public services, so they have to pay for them, like public services. And I'm actually hopeful that there will be recognition. It may not be exactly what the charity sector wants, but I'm hopeful that, because it can't go on like this. I did the research for this report, it's bad. The other is I'm hoping that the philanthropic sector steps up, because it's not as developed in Ireland as it is in places like the UK. I realize it's a really small country, but even if you look at countries like New Zealand, there's a lot more donation or giving than there is. And that philanthropic sector will give not just some financial stability to charities, but also the capacity to advocate, which they often can't do because they're receiving government funding. Again, to go back to the reason we exist is because there are social problems that you have to have a good, healthy, robust debate about why problems exist and what should be done about them in order to actually address them. And I think that I'm hopeful about that too, that there'll be more of a philanthropic sector in the future, and that will help the charity sector.
So do you mean, this is like a really interesting topic as well, but do you mean when you talk about, you're talking about large scale contributions, you're talking about, which is it, because we consider ourselves, Ireland considers itself to be a very pro-business country, right?
Before yeah.
So foreign investment. Do you see that as a gap that isn't being filled at the moment for, say, big businesses who are positioned here in Ireland? Could they be giving more and doing more to support the charity sector?
It's businesses, it's individuals setting up trusts and foundations. Mm. I think it would be great. And it's great to have a diversity of trusts and foundations with different interests that would give donations. Like, you know, in an ideal world, if the government doesn't want to fund governance, then maybe there is a private, it shouldn't, government should fund governance. If they want governance to be done properly, then they should fund governance. That's unfair. But let's say innovative projects. Let's say the government says, okay, we're going to give you, you know, one of the things it's we're just talking about keeping the status quo. We're not slipping back too far right now. But what's missing from this discussion is innovation. Like, yeah, what do you do about people who in their 70s have been drug, you know, who've survived, who have had a long history of addiction? You need specialized services for them, right? So how are you going to develop that? Where's the funding to develop that? It would be great if there's a robust philanthropic, robust philanthropic sector, or a number of foundations who are like, okay, that is really interesting. We are going to fund an innovative project in how to deal with it. People who are aging, who've had multiple problems with addiction, or maybe like class A drugs. So that, to have access to that. So if the government can't keep up with innovation, then maybe you can get that from foundations and trusts and business, et cetera.
And I suppose I have many hopes, so I'll try to distill them. But I suppose agreeing with and building on what Shana was saying, that as well as fostering that kind of innovation and new approaches to things, that there is a long-termism built into the work of charities as well. And I don't even mean sort of 20 years down the line, but, you know, another thing we talk about in our budget submission and in our campaigning more generally is the question of multi-annual funding. Because at the moment, you know, lots of even service provision organizations chase funding on an annual basis from both the state and maybe private funders as well. And it means that you're in a constant battle to just continue existing the next year. And it doesn't give you that space to actually develop what you're working on and to think about innovation and to think about new things you can be doing. You're always worried about just keeping the show on the road. So allowing that, and I suppose to bring the conversation back to where we've been, it's part of that as well, that by locking in pay parity and making sure that it is increasing with new public sector pay agreements, you're making sure that we're not locked in this fight again and again and again and again, and that we have a sector that can thrive instead of constantly fighting to survive.
And now, in a new addition to the Good Stuff programming, we have our Members' Voices section. Each episode this season, we'll hear from a representative of one of the Wheels member organisations speak on how their organisation is affected by or involved with the main topic for that episode. In this first Members' Voice section, we'll hear from Sarah Reeves, Director of People and Organisation at DePaul Ireland, who've been a member of the Wheels since 2005. Sarah tells us a little bit about the incredible work done by DePaul all across the island of Ireland to help people who are experiencing homelessness. Sarah also explains how the difficulties in recruitment and retention directly affect the day-to-day running of DePaul, as well as their ability to plan for a less than certain future.
Hi, I'm Sarah Reeves, Director of People and Organisation in DePaul Ireland. I've been with DePaul just over 5 years now. DePaul is a cross-border charity in the area of homelessness and homeless prevention. Last year, we celebrated 20 years of service in Ireland. We currently have 38 services, 29 in the Republic and 9 in Northern Ireland. We employ just over 600 people and have close to 100 volunteers. We work with people on the margins of society who are at risk of homelessness or experiencing homelessness. We support people with multiple needs such as addiction and mental health issues. We offer low threshold services whilst focusing on harm reduction techniques. Our staff approach the work in a trauma-informed way, work with expertise and professionalism to support the most excluded and complex. As everyone knows, we are in the midst of a worsening housing crisis, and more people than ever are accessing emergency accommodation. In 1 year alone, it has increased by 20%. As a homeless charity, we are supporting more people than ever and with less staff. We, like many other organisations in the community and voluntary sector, are experiencing a crisis in recruitment and retention. This has severely limited our ability to respond to everything that is asked of us. And we have to be very careful about taking on additional services, as we don't want to put any of our current services at further risk of closure. It's critical that we can offer more competitive salaries so we can recruit and retain staff that are needed to be able to respond to this deepening housing crisis, whilst also adhering fully to the extensive regulatory requirements that are in place within the community and voluntary sector. We receive funding through Section 10 and Section 39, and this is to deliver public service contracts from the state. Our staff do not receive pay or employment conditions close to public sector employees. The cuts and stagnation in funding over the last decade means we are being left behind our counterparts in the public sector. There is currently a pay gap of 15% between ourselves and the public sector. Wage cuts were imposed on us and the public sector after the economic crash over a decade ago. It has been reversed in the public sector, but remains in place for Section 39, 10 and 56 charities. There has currently been a consistent level of fast-paced inflation in recent times, and this is putting a huge pressure and strain on our staff. At this point in time, industrial action through the form of a strike is imminent and scheduled for this Tuesday, the 17th of October. Overall, the impact of this recruitment and retention challenge is that we cannot fill vacancies in a timely manner with suitably qualified and experienced people due to the approach to the pay within the community voluntary sector in the last decade. We are competing with the public sector for experienced staff who can work with people with complex needs. We lose staff all the time to the public sector. As an organisation, we are very committed to learning and development, and the organisational growth we've experienced in recent years has enabled a level of staff progression. It has, however, masked to a degree the level of challenge in the recruitment market. However, since the pandemic, we are seeing more people apply for external roles at a much higher level of pay and take up jobs in the Department of Housing and HSE where their experience and skills are highly sought after. We are looking for our funders to firstly address the current pay deficit of 15%. Secondly, deliver pay parity between Section 39 and 10 organisations and include state-funded charities and public sector pay talks and other relevant fora such as the WRC to prevent a future re-emergence of pay disparities.
That's it for now. Next time, we'll be discussing the invaluable role played by volunteers in keeping Ireland's CV sector on its feet, and in particular, the essential practice of recruiting diversely and valuing the time and contribution of volunteers from a huge range of backgrounds and life experiences. Thank you again to all our contributors, to Shayna Cohen, Emily Burke, and Sarah Reeves, and thanks especially to you for taking the time to listen. If you're involved in a charity, voluntary, or community organisation, no matter how large or small, or if you'd just like to learn more about the non-profit sector here in Ireland, go to www.wheel.ie to find out more and to join our community of members. All the best.